Let us begin the fourth session on climate and the change in the climate. And this is the last of our sessions here at the Holbrook Village, Holden Village. I'm Alden Bryant, and I understand our session is now together. What we're going to do is review the fundamentals, the basic common sense approach to what is happening with our climate and why. And this is not a matter of theory, it's a matter of these are the main things that are taking place now in our country, in Europe, and across the entire northern and southern hemispheres. So we'll do a quick review of the symbols I put down on this chart. We have four slides, and then today we're concerned with really the whole relation of human beings and nature, the earth and the atmosphere, the balance, and what is an ethical position in life, what is happening, and what are we going to do about it? Where is our involvement? Therefore, we have a limited time. We want a lot of discussion, maybe half the time, back and forth among all of us here. And now this will be rapid, and you're certainly free to stop me or make any comments you want along the way. And I think they'll be picked up. It's the job of the people in the audio system to try to get all the discussion from the people in the room. In this case, I'm just going to, without even asking where everybody is and what your knowledge and experience and concerns are, I'm just going to run straight through. Let's think this way, that we have had glacial cycles for a long time. You know, in the history of our entire globe, there's been movements of the continents, considerable movement. And in their present formation, we can say that they've certainly been here for 2 or 3 million years or much more. But the geologists have only gone back about 2 million years in the glacial cycles and the evidence in the Earth's surface. So here's a diagram of just a line going up and down. We've had about 22 of these cycles recorded, and each one is a matter of a great deal of ice forming in the Antarctic and in the Arctic areas, coming down, as you know, clear to New York in the last ice age, maybe a mile deep outside of New York, and across the center of the country and some down California, the west coast. So these volume of ice in the world runs from a figure of about 30 at the minimum in these cycles up to about 70. And the units, and remember, I'm part of an organization, the Earth Regeneration Society, that came together to get information and to be in touch with scientists in many fields to deal with this question here and in other countries. So what we have is kind of a collection of material, and just these are just summary items and figures from a lot of workshops. Now the volume here, and I just sort of pointing out that I myself did not have familiarity with a lot of this material 6-7 years ago, namely the ice volume. Anybody want to volunteer what units scientists discuss the volume of ice? See, it's in millions of cubic kilometers. So stop and think a minute. What's the size of a cubic kilometer? So it runs from 30 to 70 and up and down, and this is approximate, just visually looking at the science of the materials. And they run from each about 70 to 110,000 years in each one of those cycles. Now we are at a point, here is the last turnaround from a nice calm interglacial period of 10, 11, 12,000 years into a carbon dioxide increasing, going into glacial conditions, coming down, and then coming back up into our last interglacial that we're in right now. We're here. And the CO2 has gone up from 280 parts per million, beginning of our century. Let's go to this little drawing here. This is a level of about 280 parts per million in our atmosphere. That's very small. But the point is that when it increases rapidly up to a 347, that concentration means a lot more particles of carbon in the air. And when the sun hits the earth and warms it and reflects heat back, it's near infrared radiation there, the carbon catches it, absorbs and reflects it. So it's warmer. It evaporates more moisture. So you visualize a lot more moisture being raised in the atmosphere down around Mexico, Central America, near the equator. And when that, because that's where the sun hits directly the most intensely. Now, when that moisture tends to move toward the higher latitudes and hit cold areas, what happens? It condenses. You start with a lot more cloud coverage. Maybe you've flown across the country and seen a great deal more. The state of Illinois has an official report showing a great increase in the last 10 years. Then goes a little further and it condenses and comes down as snow in the higher latitudes. There's considerable increase in snow cover. This sort of diagrams the snow moving further and further south. And in 73, our satellite pictures had a peak, the highest coverage in the northern hemisphere. Then in 85, it was 18% greater, not only in North America, but Europe and the Soviet Union. They're all over 18% more coverage. And this is because of far more moisture coming up and dumping. It comes up in the lower latitudes and comes down higher up. Now, it comes down as rain, as snow, and slow ice formation. There's nobody here from Maine, but that, I don't think. They had the worst floods in their entire recorded history. It was January this year, I believe. The Great Lakes have been coming up steadily for a long period of time, and Salt Lake. The floods in many areas are worse. Now, when you have more snow coverage, and you have more and more warming going down in the lower latitudes, just think. Those areas are coming closer together. The temperature difference is more. So what happens to all the air currents? You know, what have we read about tornadoes? There's been a very rapid increase. And an amount of damage. Then along with these changes, this pattern, the more snow cover you get, think of the masses of cold air that develop, and when they start moving down, that's why we're
Excuse me, Alden, but isn't part of the reason the wind speed around the globe increases because of the deforestation? That's what I've read, I guess. How would you respond to that? I read an article that said that since 1950, the wind speed around the globe had increased 4 miles an hour.
I can't respond to that. What I would do, if there was something being discussed, I would be in touch with the people whose field of work that is. Now, if you read an article like that, then we would be very glad for you to send us the reference, because people around this country and others are just coming closer and closer association. We share this stuff. So I'd be very glad to see that. What I was going to point to here is that the cold air coming down is again something that's very clear and obvious to us because of the record cold each year, each winter. It's getting more and more record cold spells in the Midwest and the East, and clear down to Florida. And then to wrap it around a little, you saw pictures of snow in Saudi Arabia? Anybody see those pictures in the newspaper? In southern Italy, it's also had snow where they don't ever recall it before. And when I was in Hungary, they pointed out that they lost a lot of their grapes from freezing spells coming down that they had not encountered before. So that's part of this cycle speeding up. And as those cold fronts come down, they are very much involved in knocking out crops. This comes in many ways, such as a warm spring, and then all of a sudden a heavy rain and windstorm knocks all the almond blossoms off in California. We lost 90% in 1 year recently. Or I understand in Minnesota, they've had some cold spells come down, and hit the buds and blossoms and lost a lot of their fruit crop, apples. So that's why we've drawn it this way. Now, let's go back here. In the soil, over, let's go back to a glacial period. Imagine a full glacial period with a maximum ice, let's say 18,000 years ago, when the ice is at its thickest and then it's starting to melt off due to changes in the forest and the general atmosphere. At that time, up through here, you know, the ice has been grinding rocks steadily, and a lot of that dust comes out underneath, flows out the rivers, and builds up in masses and blows around a good part of the earth. And volcanic action, such as the Azores, contributes more. So this is the remineralization of our earth. This happens each cycle. The minerals over this period of time get used up, leached out, eroded, some washed down to the rivers and the ocean. The minerals now are about 25 to 40% down, different amounts in different areas. And our main source, remember, is our biggest soil testing lab in New Knoxville, Ohio. They handle over 1 million samples a year. We've been in constant touch. We're there for a few years now, their director. The forests are about half cut down compared to 2,000 years ago. They're not there to take out the CO2, so it's going up. With the CO2 going up, we have this cycle, and the weather is going crazy and going into more and more extremes of heat in the summer, like Georgia last summer, and extremes of cold, which is resulting in, up in this area, the rain, snow, and ice formations. So, to summarize, why? Well, now what we have to do about it, we show as a nice red line here, a positive, sort of hopeful symbol, of rebuilding soil minerals, rebuilding the forests where they're dying, and planting a great deal of new forest, bringing down the CO2 and stabilizing the climate. Now I passed around some photographs in the past, and we'll just start them around again. Number one is the country that's doing the most to remineralize soils and do experiments along that line. It's Austria. Under their Academy of Science, they're using rock dust. They're taking dolomite rock. That is a very good cross-section of the minerals and trace minerals in nature over here, basically. So they grind it to very fine powder, like talcum powder size. In this case, their approach is to spray it out over the soil and the forests. And the forests have been coming back to life in the last 3 to 5 years. And then here's a little picture of a farmer down in New Zealand who's been using good rock dust and experimenting with different kinds of rock dust. And he's got himself some beautiful celery, the size you may never have seen. But it's not just size, it's the quality of the minerals in the vegetable, which makes them stronger to resist pests, and it's good for human health. Very important. Now, here is a program to deal with it in our Earth Regeneration Society, which is a small kind of a catalyst group. We're a board of directors of 5. We're in touch with about 70 main science people around the country who are concerned with these things. We're sort of a loose association this way. Some are working very hard on these materials and publishing data. And there's maybe 2,000 or 3,000 mailing lists. And we've been for the last 5, 6 years in many conferences in this country and internationally as part of just developing and bringing this forward. Now the Russians sent a top team to Budapest because they are very concerned. Now you know the nuclear winter studies. You know, if a nuclear bomb goes off, we may have tremendous fire, dust problems, and cooling of the earth, and that's tremendous effect. Now, you know the Russians had a team working on it. At the same time, the U.S. had a good team working on it. Their people came to this conference in Budapest. They are that concerned. It's from their computer center and planning center in Moscow. as part of a wrap-up, we need to sense what is happening around the world. In 1984, we took a delegation of 25 people and toured the entire Soviet Union, the entire country, for 31 days and met with six groups in their Academy of Science and had talks about these problems. We asked them, are you ready to work on an international program to do these things? And we found that they were interested, but they're each working their own disciplines, just like this country. There was no real central movement around it. And that was 3 years ago. So June of this year, they sent their top team. They're very concerned. And we came out in agreement that they're going to explore much more than they have before. And that's written up in the news release on that meeting. I think I gave some of you a copy of that. Now, why haven't we been seeing this in the media here before, in the U.S.? You know, that's a very important question. And the reason is, there's a small reason, namely oil and coal industry doesn't want to have cut back, because when you burn them, you get an awful lot of CO2 coming out. Carbon dioxide is the main emission. So they don't want to have cut back or go into a transition to alternative energy. See, no one company can do it in a given industry. It has to be a major government decision for the whole industry to do it together in a smooth transition on who works where and who invests where. And you can't have a government decision until there's enough awareness in the country to demand it so that a certain person can run for office and know that he has support on this in his own constituents. Now, why hasn't it been moving? The reason is that in the late 60s, early 70s, there were a number of people in this country saying, yes, we're going into glaciation, into cooling, and we've got to consider it. In August of 74, the CIA Research Department put out two excellent short articles, about 30 pages each, saying the climate is changing, food will be knocked out, and governments will be destabilized. Their job is to inform Congress of what's happening so that they can relate to it. So they did their job. 2 years later, a top policy, top industry group, including, and I've drawn a little black group here, the Oil Investors Association. Now that's an international body, includes the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Scripps. And the Scripps own a whole newspaper chains, but mostly oil investments. And one of the science people married into their family was a part of the Oil Investors Association. And this interrelates with a major policy group at high levels in the U.S., and they decided we don't want to have any public discussion of this full cycle. We'll put up a cover story and make sure that none of this half goes out in any of the science literature or in the public. So for 10 years, there's been a little cover story that says, oh yes, there is CO2 and it's warming, greenhouse effect is just warming, it'll melt the pole someday, it'll raise the oceans a little. And up till a few years ago, they were saying, don't worry, it's way in the future, don't do a thing about it. Now that was an intensely held cover story. Now why was it so important? Actually, it was run by this policy group that may also relate to the whole Iran gate kind of situation, policy making from very high levels inside a lot of the corporate structure. This one scientist, Roger Revelle, in his 70s, was the person who was in the group as part of it, and also he was head of the Scripps Institute in Southern California, and this sort of thing. And they had about four people working with them that they arranged, and through that was a control of the main government agencies, Department of Energy CO2 Office, Environmental Protection Agency, in the main science literatures. Revell sits on the chairs of the Climate Committee for the American Association of Advancement of Science and sits on the American Academy of Science committees to deal with this. So it's very carefully controlled and orchestrated on down. And the main computer center that deals with climate is in Colorado. It says warming, they have a neat little formula, and they leave out the total forest cover, the soil condition, the amount of cloud cover, and the thickness of snow. It's getting more and more thick in the winters, and it's lasting longer into the spring. They're not considering that. And the Russians, we told them, we said, we don't know why, but it looks like you've just been sucked in. We told them directly. You know, their eyes got kind of big, you know, they speak English well. We were on a give-and-take basis. And I said, it looks like you've really been taken in, because CO2 can't double from, say, 300 up to 600, as some of these people were talking about, they say, if it does that, then the world will get warmer. And we pointed out that the limits on increasing CO2 have to do with how far the forests are going to die out. And they've already come down so far that CO2 cannot go more than just a 20, 25 points, some relatively small amount is the furthest it can go, based on the death of forests. Now, if you burn a lot more oil and coal, you push it up a little more. And that, too, may have sort of an upper limit. So these are questions that they're going to consider, which were not in the computer models here. I taught maybe the first course on this in the country. It was at John F. Kennedy University, back of Oakland, small school, about 2 years ago. And it was called Regenerating the Earth. It was on the full cycle, and the full material, and the number of science background materials. And by the way, Thresa Hertzfeld was one of the best students in that class, and was an intern with this effort for a year. And that was a wonderful thing. Bishop Hertzfeld, by the way, is on the board of advisors for this effort. Now let's go ahead and wind this up and show that why that meeting in October 76. The policy group that made that decision had been important during the 60s and early 70s. And food was a very important lever. Now we'll take one example. In Chile, when they had the change there, and the Pinochet government came in, and there was the massacre of maybe up over 10,000 people. That was a time in which our Congress said, don't send any more military weapons to that area. This inside policy group kept doing it, and they did it by sending surplus food, Commodity Credit Corporation food, up to, in 1 year, 75, I think it's up to about $65 million worth. The government would take the food, sell it to their people, and then use the money to come back and buy weapons from the U.S. weapons manufacturers. So here's Congress, the American people, saying that's a terrible situation, stop it, don't support it. And here's this inside group running it, just like the Iran gate thing. Now that's food policy, part of it. They realize that they can no longer do some of this thing and get away with it as they have, if this is fully known in the public, is fully part of an international understanding, and this kind of physical program is put forward in individual countries, in the United Nations. The people are going to cooperate. It'll be a tremendous attempt to stabilize here and keep and survive. So the goals and the policies are going to shift. So I drew a sort of the line of hope and upcoming involvement and understanding of people more generally. That's why I came here. And Bishop Hertzfeld says, just tell the truth and deal with this. And we've been exposed to this for 6, 7, 8 years now. Now, what does this represent? And I drew it in the following way. Where in the world do the forests grow the fastest? The species that'll grow the fastest and take CO2 out of the air the fastest. So how do we do the best job as a world as a whole? Those are mostly third world countries. So that's saying that the job is going to become support for third world countries and their forests. Now we've never thought of that before as a survival problem. Forests grow, and this is from our foresters on the faculty at UC Berkeley, University of California. They say, think this way. When you look at a forest, there's a lot of dying of trees, there's a lot of new growth. So there's a net growth rate. And the figures are, they talk in terms of cubic meters per hectare per year, you know, about 2.4 acres. These are the same units we found that one of the people here, a forester from England, is quite familiar with these kinds of figures. Now, down near the equatorial areas, that number is about 15 cubic meters hectare per year. As you go up to Finland, with cold weather and with less topsoil, very difficult conditions, it's about 2. So Professor Paul Zinke said, if you're figuring an international program, use a figure of 10 for temperate zones and the average program around the world. So if you're raising enough forests over a short period of time and doing the soil work and the alternative energy development and jobs in that area, you're going to try and bring this down in time. The problem is to bring that down, and while you're bringing it down with this kind of program, as many years as it's above that line, it's dumping more snow up here, and the climate conditions are getting more intense. So we're going to have greater losses year by year, even though at some point we're going to have an all-out program on this. We have to. The very changes in climate are going to demand it. It's a question, how fast can we get this out in the open, and get legislation in Congress, and get it going. Now, we have a bill, it's out, it's under review now, and when we finish rewriting, we will start working with people in Congress to start a three-year process. At that time, from our organization and every group that we're a part of, we want to have it understood and for people to respond whatever way they can. Whether it's community groups, religious organizations, trade unions, business groups, political parties, and all be in the act, and we have contacts. In California, the Democratic Party has officially put this in their platform in 1984. There's glaciation coming, we need reforestation, and it's international cooperation, and that's in their platform. And this year they passed an action to support legislation on employment of this sort. Okay, can we just turn it on? We got 4 slides, and this sort of illustrates the kind of things we do in a workshop over the years. Thanks. First of all, we wanted to point to the empty chairs. We had a bit of a chuckle about that before. If we don't run this program, if we don't bring this down in time, if we don't stabilize this, there's going to be an awful lot of empty chairs, in the sense that we're pretty much at risk when we can't raise crops in the temperate zones. And the rate at which this is changing, the rate at which all of these conditions are getting more and more intense, we're going to have serious problems in the next 15 or 20 years, and we're going to start being seriously at risk. And that's why we're putting full time on this and started on an emergency basis back in about 1980 and set up this nonprofit corporation in 83. And a number of us have put 5 years just around the clock trying to develop this and get it moving. So that's why I thought those empty chairs to sort of suggest a few things. And in our business connections, we say your annual report just won't look very good if there's nobody around to work on your facilities. Or even some of the top people in the church, you know, leaders in the Lutheran church, you know, what's going to happen? There's not many people there to come around. So you see the CO2 curve on the left, and we drew it rather generally back a few years. Then on the right, you see the arrows going around in a circle. With the warming action, the CO2, the warm, moist air, the movement toward the poles, cloud formation, the heat loss, and then the snow and ice buildup. And then to the right, you see tectonic system, the great plates of the earth on which the continents rest. And when you put a lot of pressure on the poles, a tremendous snow buildup, where's it going to squeeze out? You know, earthquakes and the volcanoes, like St. Helens here. And tremendous earthquake action in Managua and Mexico City and Los Angeles area, some. And then there are points in the cold fronts coming down and knocking out agriculture. So this is something came out of workshops for a couple of years and a great deal of information coming in. This shows the kind of work that's been done. The top level shows the CO2 curves. I'm going to come over here. Here we are now. Here we are back 140,000 years. Here's the last turnaround. Here is our interglacial period now, and the CO2 going from the 280 up to around 347, nearly 350. And this turnaround is about at or higher than it was back there. The use of fossil fuels is probably driving, going to drive this higher than the turnaround last time. And you see the CO2 varies a lot, but it stays down in here and doesn't go nowhere near at that high. That's why we are in a period that's different from variations going on along in here. Like the little ice ages, 9, 1000s, 1500s, along that kind of period. This is a history of the global ice volume of the world. You can see that about 18,000 years ago, it starts melting off. The forests have come back enough to take a lot more of the CO2 out of the air, and there was not a constant snow buildup to build up the ice, but it begins receding. And there are many things happening that bring this about. World's temperature history, it has been developed roughly and showing that it's slowly coming back down again now. But remember, we've had some pretty cold things in the 1800s. People back from that generation maybe sent stories through. Then there was kind of a warming in the U.S., definite warming, 1900 up through the 30s. From about 1940 on, it's been going down rapidly in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. But in the U.S., it's very clear that along California, Oregon, and Washington, has been a relatively warm area. And then for a while in Montana, there was a warm spot, and that's moved over into Minnesota. So you have some very warm summers and not as cold winters for a little while. And then in the Great Lakes area, I'm told it's usually 90s in the summer, the last summer is the 60s and 70s. And across all of Canada, where it's far cooler. 2 years before, the same thing was happening down there in the Soviet Union, in Georgia, in the southern part, in the city of Tbilisi. We were there on our tour. And when they heard why we were there on this environmental tour, they came to us and told us their temperatures were down 7 or 8 degrees centigrade. Around 15 or so Fahrenheit, both in the summer and the winter, and they were afraid for their food crops. Maybe that's a big thing for their whole country.
That Nino make any difference for them?
El Nino? El Nino has a lot of effect. There's more over in this area, and I'm not an expert on that, but I know some of our people have worked with it a lot. It's a very significant thing, but it's tied into the entire cycle that's going on. Okay, now watch this one. This is a result of people in the Society for General Systems Research saying there's some main things happening and a lot of others that bear on it and have an effect. So here's forest and plant life, that's going down. The CO2 is going up. We're going into the glacial period. And let's see about focusing. Things like timber cutting is going to add to the downgrading of forests. And slash and burn agriculture, burning fossil fuel adds to the acid rain, which has an effect on soils, which has an effect on the forests. So this just to show you that this is the kind of work that, in fact, this was a man who was a scientist who was down in Argentina, did the basic work for this. And a woman architect, an artist in this country, did all the final drawing. Barbara Logan is up in Trinidad, California at this point. Now, this was kind of a just an outline thing to say, look, here we are now, and here's, let's say, all the people on the globe, and our objective is to build a program to reduce carbon dioxide, the soil and forest and energy work, high employment activity. You build that program up and run it as hard as you can for a long period of time, 20, 30 years. If we don't, then there's going to be minimal losses if we do it. Maybe this is 15 or 20% of the world's population. But if we don't run a program to our best ability, then pretty much everybody is going to be at risk because there won't be crops coming through in the temperate zones. So this says we're pretty much all at risk if we don't run that program. Well, that's the kind of thing that we've been going around and around on now for a number of years. Okay, turn it off now. So we're going to be 4:35. So it's up to you.
Could I ask you a question? You didn't mention ozone. Does this play in somehow?
We consider ozone to be almost entirely a separate matter. Think of the carbon dioxide in the soil and the forest in the atmosphere near the Earth. Then think of ozone, oxygen 3 molecules, ozone much higher up and subject to certain chemical actions that may destroy, that are destroying some of the ozone particles. So the process of whether you increase or decrease ozone is almost entirely separate of what's happening with carbon dioxide in the climate cycle.
What happened in California last year was a dry year. Have any moisture last year?
Well, that's part of where we think of the U.S. I didn't draw the U.S. here, but that shows that sort of relates to the 40-year history of being somewhat warmer here on the West Coast near the Pacific Ocean. We have a lot more warm air masses coming up along the coast, and the additional rains and additional snow buildup is more intermittent in California.
Aren't we looking at, in this whole concept, though, too, something that is more long-term than one season as it fits into a period of 20 years, so to speak? So in other words, like last year in Minnesota, too, was very dry, this last winter, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's only one season in a long trend toward a cooling period, isn't it? And it was much warmer winter for us, too.
Yeah, well, think of the jet stream that's like 35,000 feet, somewhere in that range above. You see it in television, the climate, their weather portrayals. And that starts basically one of the great plateaus over in the Soviet Union and moves across the Pacific and across the U.S. and winds around and down not too far from Florida. And the way that changes has a big effect on the climate conditions along through here. Now, that's roughly what I hear from the climatologists. So that accounts for considerable change, but think in terms of what's happening as a whole here. And let's say the last 40 years have been very significant in the turnaround in the northern hemisphere here, from a slight warming to actually coming down fast. Then the last 10 years have been particularly significant for record cold temperatures in the Mideast, the Midwest and the East. And now we've got, in the next 15 to 20, we're going to have very serious problems with food crops coming through. Late storms and floods and early frost, you know, and intermittent hot and cold. And if you see that expanding, just going up, just the way the CO2 curve's going up. So that's kind of a time period thing. But now people raise the, well, why should I make up questions? What's on your mind? Where are you from? What's happening?
One of the overall pictures that I'm struggling with is that one issue is that we're going into a glacial period. There's no way of stopping that is what I'm hearing. The thing is that
please let me interrupt. The whole objective is to stop that, level it out through this work. Completely level it out.
Okay, so it is possible that we would never go through another ice age, you're saying?
That's the objective.
Okay. It isn't just a matter of slowing it and that we have contributed to it and now we need to slow that, but okay.
That's the meaning of bringing this down. If we can bring down the CO2 and it stops dumping so much more snow and building it up, we can hold it where we are, roughly, and continue with something much damped out. And we're not sure, maybe half the people of Canada are going to have to come down or move further down. Because we're told that people only 600-700 miles up can almost not grow the vegetables in the backyard now.
Because what this, you know, as I look at that, man comes onto that whole picture for the first time in this glacial
Where were your ancestors 122,000 years ago?
Yeah.
Who knows? And there weren't many people. Right. And they were down in these, of course the oldest records are down over in here in the Olduvai Gorge in Kenya in Africa. And then southern France. The Lascaux Caves go back, 18,000 years, something like that. And those records, those are beautiful paintings. I was in there in 61, the last year they were open. So.
I left to live on the west coast in Washington. They ship logs to Japan. Now they raised the price about 3 weeks ago to the highest that they've paid for a long time, and the record cutting was going on. Ships loaded way below the insurance mark go early in the morning before anybody wakes up, and they ship daily. Now, they don't replant. Are you going to try to work a reforestation program and force it on them, or will that be a part of the country in itself? I talked to a lady from California, and they, Civic Lumber in Scotia, used to plant 2 trees for every one they cut. They haven't done that. The new company bought them from Germany 10 years ago. They've been just cutting steady, never replanting. Is there anybody in your company that will make them replant?
Anybody else want to respond? I got lots to say. Two things. The same story is coming from Trinidad area in Northern California, where a company had been there for 20, 30 years and had a very careful environmental program of cutting small areas, reseeding. And if it's small areas at a time, the forest can come in better. As compared to a whole mountainside that's open and just erodes and it never can get back into the trees very, very well. So they had a fine history. Then a new company bought them out, and now they're just going to clear cut and try and make a tremendous cutting and just destroy the area a great deal to pay off the high cost of buying the company. And so that's happening a lot. Now, what's our response? Our response is to try and write into this piece of legislation a national planning process. First of all, the work. And we have a program in that yellow sheet you've got of employment in the U.S. Changing people from some industry to others, less coal miners, more building alternative energy in the soil and forest work. Coal miners can come above ground, but they and their leaders have to be part of the process of planning it. The job training, the transition, it's got to be part of their program, or of course it wouldn't work. We met twice with the president of the Mine Workers Union. We've run into each other at the meetings. So this kind of employment has got to be written into the bill. The bill also has to include setting CO2 targets by regions. What are you doing? Are you going to increase it or are you going to bring it down? Are you going to have more rapid transportation and using less gasoline fuel? Are you going to have a big reforestation and employment program? All of these things. So you add them all up for each region. Philadelphia had a meeting on this a year ago and set up a special little organization with 60 community leaders, environmental leaders, saying we'd like to be a model program to start working in this direction. Well, so the answer is it's got to be in the legislation for the national. We're trying to write everything in it we can. And anybody here who wants to leave their address, our job is to send you copies of that bill so that you can see it, comment on it, show it to anybody in your own family and community that you want to.
Excuse me, but the United Nations has done incredible studies also on desertification, the exact same things that you've been working with, and they have come to the same conclusion that reforestation is the basis. They are trying to do massive education, which is what you're trying to express to us, that to change legislation you have to get the masses educated in order to push the legislation through. They're working on, are you working with the United Nations at all?
The response is yes, and I'll give you two ways. First of all, there's an announcement over there on the bulletin board of a conference coming up. You can look at it. It's a religious groups, ethical and environment national conference. And they're saying that, there's some quotation in there, that the religious groups in this country are the largest moral force for a movement in this direction of anybody's. And that's why the background for their holding this conference later this year. Now, the United Nations. The director of the North American body for the environment program, which is part of the UN, the director is Noel Brown in New York. We've been close personal associates. He's been supportive of this. He even tried to put some of his budget into our work at one time. And it didn't quite go through. But he's fully aware of this. We met just last year in Boston at a national meeting. But he is in a coordinating role among many countries and many groups. And there is a very heavy influence from the people in the policy position in the U.S. saying it's just warming. Therefore, the U.N. materials have been kind of weak on this. And a number of reports have come out in the last 2, 3, and 4 years that say, given that it's warming, the CO2 is a problem, it's always a very short section in there. That's going to change. Now, another approach to it is there's an organization that it's called, I think, Environmental Liaison Center in Kenya. Some of you may have heard of this. They have a mailing list of all the groups around the world that are concerned with these problems. And they have about 2,500, closer to 3,000 now, perhaps. On the board of directors of that group is one of our associates from Brazil. He just wrote us a month ago saying he was at a director's meeting. He tried to bring up the full cycle of the situation. He got very heavy impact from a couple of people saying, we know it's warming and we don't want to have any further discussion on it. He wrote to us saying, give us all the information you can so he can go back there, present a fuller and stronger case and try and start swinging. So this is the kind of back and forth that's going on now and for the last couple of years. This is the year we see it as really opening up. The whole Budapest meeting and the Russians sending a top team and wanting to get fully into it. What I found in England when I was there, meeting with the Friends group, they were the most helpful. And a number of university professors, heads of departments, and then some of their newspapers. There's going to be a lot more happening in all these other areas. And I think also in the United States. Well, that's sort of covering a lot of things, but we are trying to relate through the UN wherever the people and the contacts and the conferences allow them. The UN has to be a major part of this, of course, and the Food and Agricultural Organization, and the health organizations. Well, it's 4:55. Anybody else want to make any comments? Yeah.
I just want to ask you another question. I talked to you briefly the other day, you know, about pesticides.
Yes.
I told you about the dilemma that I was aware of, or thought I was aware of. And what could ever be done, you know? And what do pesticides actually add to, as far as this whole thing is concerned?
Well, so this sort of a wind-up comment goes more into the details. When we're looking at soil, what does this mean? this positive, hopeful program. When you put minerals back in the soil, by the way, where are those nice little photographs? Okay, just put them up here. When you put minerals back in the soil, you're strengthening the crops that are growing there, and you do not need very much in the way of pesticides. We have farmers who have been putting good rock dust in their soil for 10 years, use no pesticides, and have very little loss. So this goes back to old times. The same with the forests, as you can see from Austria and other places, Australia, New Zealand, some in this country. Czechoslovakia have been working at it. So that question of remineralizing soils means you can stop using pesticides to a great degree. Now that's a goal in California. We're about the worst in this country in this respect, the most usage. And I think it's probably far more damage in the deaths of farm workers and the malformation of their children in pesticide areas. They're subject to where that spray comes down on them. This is a major thing. They're conducting a national boycott against grapes unless they are under farm worker contracts, because that'll mean five of the worst pesticides are not being used. I don't eat grapes anymore unless I pick them up at our local market and see the eagle here of the farm workers union on the box. And now, it so also happens that Dolores Huerta, who's one of the founders of the Farm Workers Union and the International Vice President, she is on the board of directors of our Earth Regeneration Society, because this whole question of agriculture and pesticides is so basic to all of us.
Yeah. I can just kind of give a testimony to that in terms of what we have seen happen in our own farm operation, and that's the fact that so frequently what we do is we farm the top 8 to 10 inches of the soil. And what I'm saying by that is that our crops only live within that. What we've found is that by using deep diving crops such as alfalfas and sweet clovers and allowing at times some of the weeds to be a part of that are deep divers, they go down to get the minerals, they bring them up, they die, the minerals are available at the top of the soil again for the crops that we do raise. That's another way, you know, it is a way that is limited. I affirm what's happening in terms of the crop or of the rock dust, that kind of thing too. But
these are the biological techniques that are so powerful.
Exactly. And what we have seen is that our alfalfa, as an example, this last year, aphids and green bug came into it in the neighborhood, and we had them on ours as much as anybody else, but the alfalfa we took off still yielded about 7 ton for the season, in which other people were using or were getting about 3 ton. And they lost a lot of their alfalfa, didn't winter. And ours sat on top of the hill and survived the winter. And was
just stronger during the cold weather.
Exactly. Everything was healthier about the alfalfa itself.
Well, since we're so close to closing up, let's also point out that when the soil is down, the minerals are down, and the trees are weaker, they can't resist the drier. And they burn faster, and the forest fires are far more, worse effects in Canada and the U.S. Also, they can't withstand the cold as much. And that's why a lot of the trees, the forests in the northern areas are dying back. We were just called by the governor's office in Massachusetts, Dukakis, by his science advisor a few months ago, saying, just to fill us in, that in Canada, in Quebec area, the sugar maples, that in about 83, they did a phone, an aerial survey, and about 37% were dead or dying. But last year, the same aerial survey showed over 80% are dead and dying, and when they cut them, they're not healing. Some people have pointed out they've been cutting them too much. But the basic problem is the minerals are down in the soil, and the cold fronts are hitting them worse and worse, so they're getting it from both ends, and they're dying back. That's a heavy story. And part of it is in some of the literature. One of Professor Kenneth Watt's articles in Davis deals with this, briefly pointing out minerals were down, but giving a lot of material on how the increasing cold fronts hitting these forests are killing the trees slowly. The sap runs in the spring, another freezing spell hits them, and the branches die, and things like this. Well, that's part of that story. We have to get up there and eat. So I say, let's officially say this closes our last meeting, but as I say that, there's something in here we didn't all get into very much, and that is, what is this new ethic of life where human society has to relate to this balance of the earth and the atmosphere like we have never looked at before or undertaken before?